From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue our look back at 2016 with Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of more than a dozen books. We spoke with him via Skype Tuesday. Dr. Horn, a pleasure. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. So very interesting year for sure, very controversial one, with a lot of changes around the world, from the election of Donald Trump here, the passing of Fidel Castro, lots of other things.
Well, let's start with Brexit, the June 2016 vote in Britain, whereby a 52-48 margin, it was decided that Britain would leave the European Union. I think that unless he manages to blow up the world, which we can't rule out, the Trump phenomenon will come and go. However, the impact of Brexit will be lingering for decades to come. And I'll get to Trump in a moment in terms of those who say the impact of Trump will be lingering for years to come. What I mean is that Britain is now becoming increasingly isolated. It's isolated itself from its European partners. You might have seen the pictures of Prime Minister Theresa May being shunned by her EU counterparts during a recent meeting in Brussels. And I think that it helps to explain why Theresa May just a few days ago upbraided Secretary of State John Kerry for his State Department speech castigating Benjamin Netanyahu's government in Israel for gobbling up Palestinian soil, even though Britain at the United Nations Security Council meeting actually voted in favor of the resolution in which the United States abstained on.
I know, right, as contrasted with the U.S. that abstained. I know, right.
Right. So, I mean, the only way to explain, it seems to me, this contradiction is that Theresa May feels this isolation. The U.S. ruling class is willing to take advantage of this isolation, and so she's trying to snuggle up, not necessarily literally, although with Donald Trump, you never know, trying to snuggle up to Donald J. Trump and get in his good wishes because of this isolation. In fact, there's been talk of not necessarily abandoning NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Association, by the United States, which Trump has suggested that he would do, but actually expanding it by inviting Britain to join NAFTA, which is something that we're all going to have to think about very deeply. As well, it seems to me that Britain withdrawing from the European Union is going to have manifold consequences for Britain's former colonies, particularly in the Caribbean, Jamaica, Trinidad, and Barbados. And I trust and I hope that the think tanks there are thinking through the consequences of not necessarily being able to get to the EU via London, which suggests that they may have to establish outposts in Brussels directly if they have not already. So I think that the withdrawal from Britain from the European Union is perhaps the major story of 2016. Of course, the Trump story cannot be ignored or downplayed. I have to say that the reaction has been rather perplexing, in some ways disappointing. I mean, look at the U.S. ruling class, which obviously is split on Trump, particularly the major newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, who are carrying on a holy crusade against Donald J. Trump. But at the same time, these members of the U.S. ruling elite are still pursuing a foreign policy, a right-wing foreign policy, that helped to propel Trump into the White House in the first place. I mean, what I mean is they're still trying to destabilize Venezuela, for example. They're still acting as cheerleaders for the routing of the left in Brazil and the indictment of Kirchner in Argentina. they're still ambivalent about the overtures to Havana, and they're unable to recognize that that kind of foreign policy inevitably sets the stage for the rise of a demagogue like Donald J. Trump. They have yet to realize that their Cold War policies pursued for decades, and of course, 2017 marks the centenary of the Bolshevik Revolution, their Cold War policies pursued for decades involved a routing of Moscow's presumed and alleged allies here in North America, that is to say the left, which denuded a good deal of what now is routinely referred to as the working class, and particularly the white working class, of any kind of defense against the vociferous rapacity of the ruling elite of the United States, which has blocked wage raises for decades now and has driven the economy into the ditch and facilitated the abandoning of the industrial core of the United States of America, leaving some in the working class to feel that their only way to rebel against the ruling elite was through a right-wing populist rebellion by dint of supporting Donald J. Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, the U.S. ruling elite has not arrived at that kind of analysis, when, of course, you shouldn't necessarily expect them to do so.
For sure.
But surprisingly enough, a good deal of the U.S. left hasn't either. I mean, it's very, historians of the future assume that we survived the Trump era are going to have a field day parsing the words of many of our friends on the left. I mean, for example, you have some of our friends who say there's no such thing as the white working class. Now, of course, that seems to me a semantic evasion, right? Because there is a working class. There are members of this working class that define themselves and are defined as, quote, white, unquote. Right. So to say that there's no such thing as a white working class is really overdetermining the idea of class solidarity and trying to liquidate the race question. And as a person who is in the midst of writing a book on the 17th century and the rise of racial slavery in the United States and how it continues to reverberate in 2016, I think that approach is particularly wrongheaded. Yeah. And then there are those who are left with this anomalous approach where they, on the one hand, say Trump is a fascist, Trump is a racist, Trump is a misogynist, Trump is a xenophobe, Trump is an all-around bad guy, but the people who voted for him are actually good people. I mean, I don't see how you arrive at that kind of contradiction. I mean, if you co-sign racism, if you co-sign xenophobia, you should not be let off the hook. I don't see how we're going to bring these misguided and misled folks back to reality if we're not able to critique them. I mean, not say this is a person who's being critiqued all the time. I mean, I participate a lot in radio discussions, particularly in black media, where people critique the black community all the time. I mean, it just goes with the territory. Right. But somehow we're not supposed to critique the 58% of the Euro-American community who voted for Trump. I mean, I don't get it. Right. So what this tells me is that there's a lot of confusion still, that in some ways the U.S. ruling elite and the U.S. progressive movement are like a boxer who's been stunned by an overhead right to the cranium and is dizzy and has not been able to regain footing and somehow is trying to spin out of it, but as of yet has not been able to do so.
You know, I'm thinking that perhaps that boxer actually entered the ring a bit dizzy from the performance, because we'll start with the foreign policy aspect of it. You know, you have this group that's actually intensified, you know, among the elite. They've intensified they've doubled down on this foreign policy in the last week. I mean, I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. They didn't expel 35 diplomats, and particularly on a holiday weekend, telling them they had 72 hours to move their families out. That, you know, as a personal affront to the diplomatic corps of Russia, that was unprecedented. And but generally, what they've been doing is to hamstring what they perceive, or what in any event the public discourse says is perceived as Trump seeking to reset relations with Russia. And also the declaration, for what it's worth, is an American politician, and particularly this one, so who knows what their word is worth, but an end to the entire practice of regime change and nation building. And that seems to be one of the rallying points of opposition among the elite to Trump's presidency. So that's on the foreign policy scale. They're actually attacking from the right, and he is actually articulating positions you would expect the left to have articulated, and they stopped doing that a while ago. And then in terms of the domestic policy, you're seeing something that was mirrored, you know, that mirrors what's been going on in Europe, which is essentially a complete vacuum on the left, giving rise to the right, raising some questions that are bothering some segments of the working class and saying, well, look, they're not giving you anything. We'll give you this much as long as you go along with us on that. That's kind of the condition that, you know, we walked into with this election.
Well, first of all, with regard to Russia, on that we agree. I think that the policy of a good deal of the U.S. ruling elite that is anti-Trump, and some of the progressive movement that's anti-Trump, with regard to trying to portray him, as Paul Krugman said, as the Siberian candidate, that is to say, a play on the
Manchurian
movie, yes. The Manchurian Candidate,
right.
Which, of course, is very revealing, since that movie was a kind of massive anti-communist, anti-Moscow trope.
Right.
And I might also say anti-Asian trope.
Right.
Hold that thought, because we're going to get to that in a second.
Right.
But I think it's really disturbing, because, number one, it bespeaks what I just said a moment ago, that people are having difficulty understanding and explaining the Trump victory without doing an analysis of the electorate. And so what it comes down to is that Putin manipulated the U.S. electoral results. He, as the saying goes, interfered in, quote, our democracy, unquote. I mean, which is...
Yeah, right.
You could go right over that one.
Term. Yeah, right.
And so that explains how Trump won. Putin did it. And this, of course, plays upon decades of anti-Moscow sentiment. And I think it also reveals the problem of what happened when many on the left began to abandon the battle station of critiquing anti-Moscow sentiment, which has been a staple of the U.S. political discourse for more than a century. And so now you have this attempt to undermine Trump by saying he's a Siberian candidate. Senator McCain of Arizona, a Republican, is holding hearings on this in a day or so. Speaking objectively, without making an editorial judgment, I think that part of the benefit of this controversy involving Trump and Russia is that it may get the Republicans fighting between and amongst each other, which is a good thing. It may serve to undermine Trump's influence, which is a good thing. But in the long run, I think it's really a losing issue to try to make a comeback on the platform of anti-Moscow sentiment, because you have the United States in the process, if not already, stationing combat troops in the Baltic republics. You know that John McCain and Lindsey Graham, his comical sidekick, just left there a few days ago.
Right.
And that's a kind of tripwire meant to signal, well, from Moscow's point of view, it's a threat to their peace and security. And of course, they've responded in kind. And it's a very dangerous scenario. Recall that before November 8th, we were talking about the U.S. ruling class being split, with the Hillary forces taking a confront Moscow first policy and Trump saying confront China first. And of course, the latter won, but the former is now trying to make a comeback and trying to get this confront Moscow first back into the pole position. Which is very curious, because I'd like to point you to an article in the January 3rd, 2017 Financial Times, a column by Gideon Rockman, their columnist, where he tries to explain all of these issues that we're talking about, Brexit, the rise of Trump, the rise of right-wing populism throughout the North Atlantic community, not by dint of the explanation I just put forward in terms of yet another chapter in the Cold War, which involved routing the left on the basis that they were all Moscow dupes and stooges. But he says it's because there is an unwillingness and inability to confront the reality of a rising China and what that means in terms of the global correlation of forces. Now, he does not say the racial correlation of forces. I guess he wanted to leave that to me. But I think that he does have a point. And once again, I don't think the left has been very helpful in terms of analyzing what the rise of Asia means, both domestically and internationally, what the rise of China means. The left has not been very helpful in pointing out that China was put in the passing lane by dint of an anti-Moscow alliance engineered by Richard M. Nixon some decades ago, where in return for China waging war in Vietnam, which it did in the 1970s, and supporting the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, Kampuchea, which it did in the 1970s, and supporting UNITA in Angola, which it did in the 1970s, that there would be massive direct foreign investment into this Asian giant. And of course, December 2016 marked the 25th anniversary of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it was thought that that strategy was brilliant, a masterstroke. Nixon to China has become a synonym in the United States for masterstroke.
That's right. That's right.
But actually, it boomeranged. It backfired because China was not content to supply cheap labor forevermore for U.S. transnational corporations. Now they're challenging Apple and they're challenging all of the U.S. transnational corporations, including Boeing, by the way,
right,
in terms of developing aircraft. And so now you have Donald J. Trump, who wants to reverse Nixonian strategy and pivot from Moscow first confrontation to Beijing first confrontation. The problem is, and I have to say, you know, even a stop clock is right twice a day. And so I have to give a proper respect to the column by David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, this on January 3rd, 2017, who describes Trump as the Snapchat president. That is to say, rather than trying to ignite this kind of foreign policy pivot, a monumental consequence, by having briefing papers and meetings and think tank conferences, et cetera, he just announces it on Twitter,
right,
basically.
Right.
That, of course, that might turn out to be his downfall. There are those who are betting that Trump will be impeached and removed within 18 months, which wouldn't surprise me, although President Mike Pence would not be a prize.
Right. And there certainly there's move, you know, already there's this more than stirrings. I'm looking at this McCain hearing, for example, as taking place before January 6th, the joint session. But I just want to go to that, the context also of Nixon's move with respect to Russia and China is the you know, closing administration of Barack Obama, whose policies essentially drove them to a point where they've declared a strategic partnership.
Who's declared a strategic
Russia partnership?
Russia and China. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, my joke is that Putin and President Xi are meeting so frequently that people are beginning to talk.
That's right. Yep.
They're beginning to think they must have a thing going on.
That's right. A bromance or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, not this fake bromance of Trump and Putin, but an actual bromance. Right. They're getting it on.
That's right. Well, they did the largest business deal in history right after the U.S. imposed sanctions on Russia. You know, they've had the military deployed to Russia's borders and really all the way to the Korean Peninsula, including the war games that they were conducting both near off Korea and in the South China Sea, the confrontation there, and they're seeking bases in India and all of that. So China sees this too.
Well, what's interesting, there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal, January 3rd, 2017, upbraiding Moscow for having a meeting in Moscow with China and Pakistan on Afghanistan, where supposedly Moscow expressed a decided lack of enthusiasm for Mr. Hekmatyar, a long-term there's no other term to use, but terrorists in Afghanistan. And, you know, Washington's upset because they think that Hekmatyar is part of the solution, not part of the problem. And all of that reveals, of course, is something that we only discuss intermittently, which is that there's been this long-term alliance between Washington and religious zealots. Now, we all know about the story of Afghanistan, right, where, of course, Hekmatyar has played a key role for decades, going back to the 70s. Right. But Syria, of course, is the latest example of this, where historians are going to puzzle over this alliance with religious zealotry. Is it just a byproduct of the undue influence of the Saudis in the U.S. political economy in terms of Saudi investors, right, being major purchasers of U.S. Treasury bills and major investors in Fox News and, right, Apple Computer and Twitter and all the rest? Mm. Is it just a function of the anti-Iranian psychosis that leads to trying to destabilize Tehran by any means necessary, even through dint of an alliance with religious zealots? Or is it simply that Washington feels that these religious zealots are just too good an ally to dispense with? After all, Russia's population is about 15% Muslim. There is this idea that Western China is vulnerable,
right,
because of the Muslim population there.
And the Uyghurs, yeah.
And that it's just an ace in the hole that they cannot give up. But in any case, it's reverberating globally because it's very difficult to seek to allegedly squash these religious zealots in Mosul and perhaps Raqqa, and then wring your hands and shed crocodile tears when they explode in Istanbul or Berlin. I mean, this is just too much contradiction to bear. But yet, once again, the mainstream press, comprised and composed of allegedly intelligent people, are somehow unable to do an analysis that would bring clarity to this complex situation.
Yeah, we're not seeing that at all. The history, of course, goes back to Brzezinski in Afghanistan, most likely before that, because somebody had to do advance work for that trip, of course. And the bogging down of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, but the continuation of things that have, you know, that occur to this past week, where you're talking about this meeting on Afghanistan and with Russia apparently trying to resolve that problem in the way that they appear to be resolving the problem in Syria.
Well, yes, of course, Moscow had a meeting with Turkey and Iran on Syria, which led to an attempt to push forward a UN resolution endorsing their proposals with regard to Syria. And what's interesting is that once again, the US mainstream press, they become sort of content free when it comes to analyzing this sort of matter. In other words, they're not analyzing whether or not this developing entente between Tehran, Moscow, and Ankara can help to squash religious zealotry, which supposedly Washington is in favor of. Right. Their only concern seems to be whether or not Moscow has stolen a march on Washington and how this reveals Barack Obama as being a weak leader because Moscow seems to be in the driver's seat. I mean, this is the level of analysis, or I should say lack of analysis, that besmirches, and I choose the word carefully, the U.S. press's reputation. Because what they're doing, to repeat, is actually preparing the ground for the kind of right-wing populism domestically that they say that they oppose when it comes to the White House on January 20th in the form of Donald J. Trump.
And finally, the Trump's going to be president absent some action on Friday, which I don't foresee, and I don't even know if it can be legally accomplished. And, of course, if he isn't shot in a plane crash or has a heart attack or something before January 20th or whatever, then there's going to be, you know, these campaign promises lingering out there, particularly the one about regime change. Now, you have, for example, facing Venezuela, the executive order by President Obama that declares Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security. You have the peace agreement in Colombia. You have all kinds of activity that's going on in Africa, with clearly the United States having installed AFRICOM playing some role. And I'm wondering if we're going to see a backing off of U.S. involvement in those things, the clandestine U.S. involvement, the above ground and above board U.S. involvement in places across Latin America, Caribbean, and Africa.
Well, it's unclear. I mean, you know, routinely and traditionally, you look at the rhetoric of an incoming president and then try to make projections about what they're going to do. But since Donald J. Trump is so contradictory, that is to say, on the one hand, he put forward a kind of isolationist, no nation building abroad program and rebuild the United States at home, spend billions, if not trillions, on infrastructure. On the other hand, he talked about bombing the expletive deleted out of ISIS.
Right.
He's talked about confronting China. In fact, in a few days, we might get a glimpse if he chooses to have a meeting with a visiting president from Taiwan, the rebel province off the coast of China, which China claims is part of its territory, right, and sees as part of its so-called core interest in a red line. Now, if he meets with the visiting president, that's the time to buckle your seatbelt. So it's unclear to me what the foreign policy course of Trump is going to be with specificity. And I think that to a degree, he may be disengaged on foreign policy because he's out of his depth, clearly. Mm-hmm. And there are a few things that he will focus on, such as making money for his family, mm-hmm, such as tax cuts for the rich, which is also making money for his family.
Yeah, right.
Perhaps assuaging his right-wing populist base by engaging in mass deportations. And footnote there, I think that all of us would be well advised to pay attention to what's going on in Mexico and the surging campaign of AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who, as you know, has been cheated of the Mexican presidency more than once.
Right.
But is surging in the polls as we approach the 2018 election in Mexico. I think that the progressive movement in the United States, given the rather skewed correlation of forces that we face, would be well advised to reach our hands across the border. There's no law, mm-hmm, that says that we have to be stuck with many of these backward folks in the United States of America in terms of trying to effectuate North American change. I mean, certainly that hasn't been the history. If you go back to slavery, right, if we had taken that approach, I'd still be sold on the open market, for example.
Right.
So in any case, I think with regard to Trump and foreign policy, that given his disengagement and his focus on kleptocracy, we'll have to look very carefully at his appointments. And because I think that his staff will have a fair amount of leeway, at least that's the way it's shaping up. And so it's unclear whether or not there'll be, for example, an aggressive take no prisoners approach to Africa, for example, or if there'll be some sort of pullback. If I were a betting man, I'd vote for the former, not the latter. And I would say that that particular approach will probably be true for the rest of planet Earth, because once again, the U.S. ruling class, of which Trump is a constituent component, is panicking right now in the rise of the face of China. And I think that in terms of generating the filthy lucre that propels them, that they not only will try to wrench it out of us, the U.S. working class and progressive movement, They'll also try to wrench it out of developing countries as well, so as to better confront China in a muscular fashion. That seems to be the way things will be going in 2017.
Dr. Horn, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.